Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net. My name is Patrick Bromley. I'm here today to talk giant monsters and giant robots with the biggest monster I know, JB.
Gojira! Run! Gojira! Gamera, come to life, Gamera.
I know, that's not the song, but that's the way I prefer to remember it. We saw Pacific Rim.
We did.
We have news for you about Pacific Rim.
What's the news?
This podcast, this website, is sort of becoming the anti-conspiracy theorist website because, like, twice a year, we discover a film that's either universally loved and we take it apart.
Sure.
I can name a few, but I won't. One of the podcasts I'm most proud of. And then there's these other films where, well, you should see Sucker Punch. You should see John Carter.
Right.
And I have a feeling that Pacific Rim is going to go under that category.
We will see. Remember, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. You can like us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter. We are at fthismovie. And email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
You could send us an edible arrangement.
Those are delicious.
Those are.
I don't eat the fruit.
You eat the... Like, it's stuck in the lettuce.
I eat the basket.
The
I eat what it's... I eat what it comes in.
It's nice that they stick everything into a head of lettuce.
Sure.
Which I discovered one night when I was really hungry. And couldn't eat the sticks. I thought you just sucked the chocolate off the strawberry.
Sometimes.
That's what you meant.
I know we've had this ongoing debate about spoilers or whatever. This movie just came out this weekend. We'll try and talk spoiler-free for a little while so you can find out whether or not you should go see Pacific Rim, and then we'll start spoiling stuff. So go ahead and keep listening until we tell you to turn it off.
Because it's going to be hard to really discuss the movie without spoiling.
I think so, but I also don't... Well, whatever. Okay, before we talk about Pacific Rim, though, JB, have you seen anything good lately?
Yes, it is summer, and the living is easy, and there's no work. There's no work to be had, so all I do is go to movies. Again, I'd like to give a shout-out to the Northwest Chicago Film Society. They're such lovely people, and they do such great work, and lately their screenings are so well attended, but they lost their venue. The Portage Theater has closed under recrimination and all sorts of nonsense, which we won't get in here. So they're orphaned, and they've been doing some of their screenings at the Music Box, which is the happiest place on earth, and it's very nice of the Music Box to lend them the space. The patio, which was supposed to close because of no air conditioning, has opened the summer just for them. And so in the last 2 weeks, I saw two very obscure films, and that's why I love the Northwest Chicago Film Society. I saw An American Romance, which was a King Vidor film made in 1944, the most bizarre amalgam of sort of a cheesy American propaganda film and then sort of Soviet techniques. I guess the studio was so unhappy, they tried to decant the narrative parts and just release it as a documentary about America's industrial superiority. Because the film goes back and forth between this immigrant story. Brian Donlevy plays this guy recently arrived, and the whole film is about his ascent into becoming a king of the automobile industry. And these fairly long passages with how steel is made and how, because he first goes to work in a silver mine and then he decides he wants to go to Pennsylvania where they pour the steel, and he learns all about that and he starts tinkering with things, and then he joins the nation automobile industry. This is all taking place in the teens and the 20s. And then he becomes a king of corporate America. And then he starts doing war work because the film ends with America entering World War II. And it was just so crazy and so weird. And in Technicolor, so even the documentary stuff was like, whoa, I've never seen this kind of footage from the period. A whole bunch of John Ford stock company shows up. John Quaylen shows up doing that crazy Swedish guy he always did. It was... I sat there and I said, I will never be able to see this again.
Right.
And then the week before, they showed Games, which is an early 70s Curtis Harrington film with James Caan and Catherine Ross.
I
have the date wrong. It's not 71. It's 68 because it's the film Catherine Ross made before The Graduate.
Ew.
And it's loony.
Yeah.
a young, rich couple like to play ironic games on each other, little tricks, and it keeps escalating, and it becomes nutty nuts.
Okay.
The program note said Curtis Harrington finally got a chance to make a Universal horror film, which it resembles. He made it for Universal, so there's clips in it from Dracula. Again, I sat there and I said, I will never get a chance to see this movie again. So, An American Romance, Games, good luck finding them. But wow.
Yeah, very cool. And they show all their stuff on film.
They're not
probably
only,
because none of it's on DVD.
They're not only proud of that, they're smug about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right.
And sometimes 16. I mean, they're very...
Yeah. It even advertises what format they're showing it on.
They usually show a short, and I guess because of the venue change, they don't have 16mm equipment at the patio yet, so they had to change the short subject, and they were apologizing for that. But
I only came here for the short!
They wound up showing this delightful cartoon about this lion and this vulture. Like, Warner Brothers trying to start another franchise, like The Coyote and the Roadrunner is successful. This is about a vulture trying to eat a lion.
Yeah. That's a thing.
But it was nuts. It winds up on the moon. And I was really glad they showed that instead of what was on the program. I have a feeling they'll continue. I'm hoping they'll make the patio their permanent home. Lately, they've been asking people to fill out a survey of where they come from, how far would you travel, what would you like to see, what would you like to see in a venue. They're the ginchiest.
And the Silent Film Society is in Des Plaines now, right?
Right. And that starts this Friday. And I've been to lots of their screenings, and it's really great. Sometimes they've got like a live jazz band playing the screening, gets you in the mood. But I have to say, their lineup this summer is so...
It's just Man of Steel with the sound turned off.
And someone playing the organ. Dun, 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 dun.
Banging a drum nonstop.
So you feel you're at the roller rink. They have this love affair with the Sheik and Son of the Sheik. I guess there's some Rudolph Valentino fans. And I don't mean to disparage what they do, because what they do is excellent. And they're showing Metropolis, which is never bad. But I wish they would seek out... I mean, the people behind it have to be so well-versed in silent film that they've seen all the Harold Lloyds, and they've seen all these. Right. There's one film on the schedule with Eddie Cantor and Clara Bow that looks rare. But I wish their programming was a little bit more adventurous. That being said, there's worse things to do on a Friday night.
Sure. Anything else besides those two?
Based on your review, I went to see The Heat.
Yes.
And perhaps because of the company I saw it in, or the very fancy theater, it was so much more entertaining than it had any right to be.
Yeah.
I laughed out loud
several
times.
Yeah.
Say what you want, that trailer that we saw endlessly just reeked of... But it's a very, very funny movie.
It is funny. There's no plot whatsoever. If you try and like pick apart what the movie's actually about, it doesn't really work on a story level, but I think it's funny.
Which is one thing that surprised me, because at one point there's a very explicit act of violence.
Yes.
A guy gets shot in the head.
Yes.
And I understand you have to do that so that we take the villain seriously and things.
Yeah.
But it seemed oddly out of place, though the film is rated R, it seemed oddly out of place in the comedy, especially because about 20 minutes later, I think this is a spoiler for Heat.
Okay.
The Heat. There's this thing where Sandra Bullock, it's a knife in the leg.
Yeah.
And it's really funny.
Yeah.
So, but the film is so breezy and encourages you not to focus on that. The Melissa McCarthy character's Boston family,
yes,
I thought was really, really funny and was really, really well cast. The father was that guy from Grease.
Yeah, that's what Erica was telling me last night. I didn't put that together.
And Jane Curtin and Bill Burr, who I thought had one of the funniest lines in the film, which I think was looped later on, and Nate Cordry, when she gets the award.
Joey McIntyre from the New Kids on the Block.
Which, that's the one I didn't recognize, and they're assorted girlfriends. When she gets the award at that ceremony, I think this was looped because he's off screen, you'll hear Bill Burr says, "Whip out the gun!"
It's a funny movie. I thought Melissa McCarthy's performance was better and more interesting than the trailers led on.
And I have to say, although I hate when they sort of pour cheap emotion on the proceedings, I honestly thought, and maybe it was just the mood I was in because I was happy, what she writes in Sandra Bullock's yearbook at the end was honestly touching.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it, well, it earned that moment, you know.
Yes.
And again, maybe it's just a function of this summer where a lot of times things are disappointing, so you go see something that is slightly better than your expectations.
It's the Book of Eli effect in reverse.
Right. It's just, wow, what a pleasant surprise.
I've been eating McDonald's for 4 months. A steak?
I don't hate this.
It's not a particularly, it's not the greatest steak, that, right. But it's steak.
It's still a steak at IHOP, but okay.
As Ian Holm says in Big Night, I like steak.
I saw a couple movies. I saw The Prowler for the first time. Which I had never seen. It's one of these sort of seminal, sure, maybe. I guess it's more of a, it's maybe down a level from the early 80s slashers. It's a slightly more obscure. Joseph Zito directed it, and it's not very good.
Okay, the reason I laughed was there's an earlier,
oh,
sort of almost seminal after the glory age noir.
No.
Called The Prowler.
Nope, and didn't see that. Gosh.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've defined the difference between the two generations.
I saw the bad Joseph Zito slasher movie, worth seeing only for Tom Savini's makeup effects. It's pretty boring for most of the movie, and then spoiler for The Prowler, it all builds to a headshot at the end of the movie that the movie essentially ends on. And you know that that's sort of the reason that they made the whole movie. Tom Savini did it so that he could make a head explode, and he does a good job of it.
There's a short chapter on that film. Now, see.
Yes.
Now you give Grandpa a few minutes to collect his faculties. There's a short chapter on the film in Savini's book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I haven't read his book. And another horror movie I saw is called The Bay. Barry Levinson made last year. It's a found footage movie about just this sort of disease outbreak in this town. And for about half of it, it's really great. And you realize, and I'm not the world's biggest Barry Levinson fan. I think I can really only think of like Diner as movies of his that I like. Yeah.
He's very good in Quiz Show as that historical character.
Yeah.
Whose name will come to me. Dave Garraway.
But obviously he kind of knows how to direct a movie, so it's interesting to see a found footage movie made by somebody who knows what he's doing. And the first half of it really works, and it's unsettling, and it's kind of creepy, and you keep wanting it to build to something, and then it never really does. It sort of repeats the first hour for its second hour, and then it's over.
I thought that film had an intriguing poster, and I thought it was mismarketed.
Yeah.
Because the marketing campaign, well, first of all, it seems like it was dumped. But the marketing campaign, such as it was, seemed to be, we don't want to give too much away.
Right.
And in doing that, they didn't give hardly anything away. And all I knew was, I think it's a horror film and it's found footage. And that's all I know.
And that's almost all there is to know. I don't think there's that much to give away. It got sort of an art house release. It was one of those movies that played video on demand and then maybe played at the Century for a couple weeks. Interesting to see Barry Levinson try and do horror, but I can't really recommend it. It is available on Netflix Instant if you are intrigued by the idea of Barry Levinson directing a horror movie that isn't Good Morning Vietnam.
As I was reminded, watching all these Mel Brooks tributes, which led to me writing about The 12 Chairs, AFI honored him, and the American Masters did this very entertaining special, although at one point, he sat down with Dick Cavett for an hour, which played on HBO, that it sometimes becomes the same stories over and over again, but because all those shows are clip fests, I kept being reminded that Barry Levinson is the crazy bellhop in High Anxiety. With the newspaper...
I remember the newspaper. I don't think I realized it was Barry Levinson. It's been a long time since I've seen High Anxiety.
I show that every year, the day that we analyze the shower scene in Psycho, because that's kind of a disturbing thing to spend 40 minutes on. Let's keep watching this woman get murdered. So I always show that at the end to kind of lighten the mood, so I see it over and over. And his performance in that high voice, happy now, happy! is really funny. And I got to say, I run hot and cold on Mel Brooks now, but spoiler alert for High Anxiety, the newspaper ink running down the drain, that's inspired.
And that's one of my first memories of understanding parody. I saw High Anxiety when I was very young, and I knew, oh, that's the thing from Psycho, because I wasn't really accustomed to something just commenting on something else.
Right.
So that scene really sticks out of my head as being happy that sort of I understood the reference. I'm not even sure I had seen Psycho at that point. But.
And I have this half-formed theory that if a parody really works, you can enjoy it without being familiar with the original.
Right.
So if you watch Fistful of Yen in Kentucky Fried Movie, I think you can laugh a lot at that, even if you haven't seen Enter the Dragon.
Yeah.
If you've seen Enter the Dragon. But I'm thinking of things in High Anxiety. At the beginning, during the opening credits, he's walking through the airport, and it's fairly commonplace, but there's this music. And at the end of the end credits, he walks out and he says, "What a dramatic airport." I think you would laugh at that without knowing Hitchcock. At one point, they're driving on this mountain road, and there's, again, this Bernard Herrmann-like score, and a bus is driving next to them with a full orchestra that's actually playing it.
Right.
I think, or the camera going through the window.
No.
There's a Hitchcock tracking shot.
Okay.
And it goes not through the window, but it breaks the window.
Right, got it.
And everyone at the dining room table turns around and looks. I think you would laugh at that. Even if you had never seen a Hitchcock film.
Yeah. The last movie I saw. Hey, what's the worst movie you've seen this year?
That's hard to say.
Okay. What's one of the worst movies you've seen this year?
The Lone Ranger.
Okay. I win. Because I saw Grown Ups 2.
Oh!
You will not see a worse movie this year than Grown Ups 2. And don't be the guy who now decides, well, now I'm going to go see Grown Ups 2 just to see for myself. Don't do it. Everything about the movie, we were not fans of the original Grown Ups.
I believe it was you who said it's one of the laziest films ever made.
And it is. Somehow Grown Ups 2 manages to be even lazier.
You were telling me this yesterday, and again, I'm not going to be that guy, but that made me want to see it just to witness.
Really don't.
How could they possibly?
Just take my word for it, they can. Again, the first movie, while not good, had a plot. Their coach dies, and they all come home, and then this doesn't even have that. They wake up in the morning, they go about their day, they have a big 80s party, because it's an Adam Sandler movie, and then they go to sleep. That's the movie.
Which is funny, because I think I've talked about this before. For many years, I taught freshmen. I taught freshman English. And for a long time, no matter what writing assignment you gave them, describe your dinner last night. Describe it so well that when I read your essay, I can taste it. The essay would start with them waking up in the morning. That's the only way they could think of to start the essay. So in this Adam Sandler film, like a group of 14-year-olds, well, they wake up. How else does something start? But this makes me think that Adam Sandler's next movie, it's going to be 90 minutes. Here's, I don't know what it's called, title TB, to be announced. He wakes up, because that's how it has to start,
right.
Is the start of a day, start of a movie. He gets in his car, he drives to the studio. That's about a half an hour of the film, him driving to the studio. He listens to a lot of 80s songs in the car, or maybe he's chauffeured. He gets to the studio, and someone's taking his parking space, so they have to park farther away. So his walk, his inconvenient walk to the studio, that's maybe another 20 minutes. And then he just walks around the studio, and he's not filming that day, because that would actually be something to watch. And he kind of talks to some craft service people that he knows and his buddies, and he pops in on someone. And then he drives home, and he goes to bed. And there's no plot, like Grown Ups 2.
I literally would rather see that movie.
But in this film, again, if you folks could suggest some titles for Adam Sandler's next film.
Fuck you, the movie.
Yeah. There's also no jokes.
Then it's Grown Ups 2. You've described Grown Ups 2.
That he's going to turn his film into the movie equivalent of an autograph show where you're paying $10 to talk to the person for a couple seconds because their autograph is worthless. You're paying $10 to watch Adam Sandler do anything for 2 hours.
But that would almost maybe help me understand him as a person better, which Grown Ups 2 doesn't do. We all ask this question over and over again as Grown Ups 2 is coming out, now that it's out. Gosh, why does Adam Sandler seem to hate his audience? And that's not the question. The question is, why does the audience go? because Grown Ups 2, right now, I think is going to be the number one movie this weekend. And I just, I can't figure... The showing I was at was not particularly well attended, but I'm pretty sure I heard people applaud at the end of it. And for the life of me, I can't understand a person who laughed at a thing in Grown Ups 2. At one point, a guy's wearing a Hawaiian shirt, and I think Adam Sandler calls him Magnum PU. That's the joke. He gets on a PA system and says, "Attention, Kmart shoppers." Like, that's still a thing?
That's like sub sitcom writing. Magnum PU.
Oh, yeah. No, there's no sitcom now.
That's like something a little kid would say in like...
And still know that it was kind of hacky.
Full House? Is that what that show was called?
Yeah. It's so bad. Don't see it because it wastes a lot of talented people. I mean, Maya Rudolph, Maria Bello.
Oh, God.
There's a ton of people in the movie that are talented. Even Adam Sandler in the right movie is talented and is just wasted. It is...
And you must know, because one of the things I enjoyed in Funny People was in the fictitious Adam Sandler character's house, there's posters for Adam Sandler movies that are fake posters, and he's now making those movies.
Absolutely.
It would be like if Tracy Morgan started making all those movies on the wall in 30 Rock.
Black Cop, White Cop.
Who dat bitch?
Who dat ninja?
Who dat ninja?
Fat bitch.
Fat bitch.
Who dat ninja?
I prefer who dat bitch.
All right, so let's talk about Pacific Rim, the other big movie that came out this weekend and did not make as much as Adam Sandler's Summer Vacation.
I will confess that at the beginning of the summer, because I love Godzilla movies and I love Guillermo del Toro, that this was one of the movies I was most looking forward to.
Sure.
It really was. Very high on my list. And then I began hearing things that I should not have listened to, but I kept hearing that it was awful. And 2 weeks before it came out, there was this thing. The studio was already convinced that it's going to tank. But like most of these things, I went to see it with an open mind. And channeling my inner 10-year-old, which I think is the key to this film, I thought it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's the greatest thing I've ever seen, but it's far from the worst. And if you pick it apart, which I'm hoping we're going to do, there were so many things in it to admire that I think might be lost on the average 10-year-old. But if I were 10, and I'm not, but if I were 10, this is a movie that I would really, really like.
Sure.
And it would fire my imagination.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed it. What did you think?
I ultimately come down on the side of liking it. I didn't love it, and there's a lot of stuff in it that I wasn't crazy about. I think, like you, it's easier for me to say, well, I like this thing and this thing and this thing, than it is for me to say, I like the movie as a whole. I like the parts better than the sum.
Very much, because on some level, it's sort of generic.
Yeah.
And at this point, JB takes a pen and writes something down on his little pad because he forgot to write it. And if he doesn't write it, he's going to forget because he's old. And we'll bring that up later.
Okay.
That the generic stuff didn't bother me because it's got to have some sort of structure. Although I think the generic stuff leads to one of the film's biggest flaws. But like you said, it's what we find Del Toro doing within that generic framework that I really liked.
There was something I felt that was kind of old-fashioned about it, just in terms of its storytelling and the arc that it kind of
I thought it
has,
was very old-fashioned in that sense.
Which felt a little bit refreshing, again, not to just keep bringing up the disappointing summer, but we've seen all these movies that are trying to subvert a formula, break away from formula, but not in a way that's successful. I like a movie that breaks from formula, but they don't know the formula enough to subvert it.
Yes, and we've seen films play games with narrative. I brought this up after we saw Man of Steel.
Yeah.
But I thought to a certain extent The Lone Ranger did too. And it seems to me the only reason they're doing it is A, to be different, because who wants a narrative structure like your grandpa?
Right.
But also because of the necessity of having an action beat every 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Keeps them from telling the story in order. But speaking of telling the story in order, one of the things I liked about Pacific Rim is there's this sort of prologue that's about 10 minutes long that could have been the first film in the franchise.
I thought the exact same thing, that I sort of went into it expecting it to be a movie where giant monsters attack and they have to figure out how to beat them, so they build giant robots and that's the movie.
Right.
But that's all taken. We're already past that point when
this
the movie starts.
This movie starts in the second act,
yeah.
Which is something I admire.
Yeah.
I was talking to our colleague Adam Riske yesterday. He said that's something he didn't like.
Oh.
That he wanted to see that fleshed out.
Interesting.
I appreciated the fact that the film very quickly gets us up to speed.
Yeah.
And again, when that little, it's no more than 10 minutes, it might even be shorter. When that was over, I thought a worse filmmaker would have made that the entire first movie.
Yes.
And we're watching the sequel.
Right.
Rise of the Humans.
And to this movie's credit, I don't think this is a spoiler, it tells a complete story.
Yes.
It's not a movie that exists to set up a franchise.
No. And it hits the ground running. So I gave it credit for that. The more I think about it, because we saw it Friday, right?
Yeah.
In the summer, I lose track of time. I don't remember the actor's name, the lead.
Charlie Hunnam.
And I don't know if this is his performance or the script. So weak.
Yes.
Instantly forgettable.
Yes.
He sort of exists to hang the rest of the movie on.
Yes.
I can't imagine that it was Del Toro's intention to make him this blank slate. But maybe it was, so the 10-year-olds could project themselves into, what's his name?
Charlie Hunnam.
Just bland beyond belief. And I kept wondering, if you had cast someone young and really, this would be a star-making role.
Yeah, it's a problem. It's a big problem because I do agree that the part is underwritten. We establish early on that he has sort of this drama. He kind of gets over it quickly, which I was thankful for, honestly. I didn't want the whole movie to be about him resisting.
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to do it again. Like they say, you have to come help us. And he says, okay. And he does. So I like that. The part is underwritten, but I agree that with a different actor, we would have been willing to forgive a lot of that stuff, I think.
Dana Stevens said the character exists to be good at what he does and have a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah. And even his chip isn't, I mean, it's
no,
not
I
like,
was really glad, like you said, that the entire film wasn't, hey, Rock, you got to get over your old right. partner, Rock.
Right.
I don't think we're spoiling anything that happens right. in the first 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But maybe because almost everyone else in the film, all in their own ways, were so interesting.
Mm.
Well, here we have to, okay, Patrick disagrees, but I would say maybe you have to decant the performance from what they're given to do.
Okay. Maybe that's the problem I'm having.
The actress who played the female lead.
Yes.
In the film, her name is...
Oh, gosh.
Mako? Mako?
Mako sounds right. Yeah.
Mako Mori. And her name is...
Rinko
Kikuchi.
From the Brothers Bloom.
I thought she was terrific. But maybe this is just me responding to the fact that she's easy on the eyes and she's very good in the action sequences. She's not given that much to do or certainly any interesting things to say, although, and we'll talk about this in a while, the backstory that they established for her, I really, really liked for a number of reasons.
Me too, and I like the way that it is revealed a little piece at a time.
Right.
That she becomes a more interesting character as the movie goes on. And I agree that I liked her a lot more than I liked Charlie Hunnam. I don't know. The movie might be trying to service too many characters because everyone is sort of sketched very thin. And I think he thinks maybe he's taking a page from like the Star Wars playbook where we have this archetype and this archetype.
Right.
But I don't think it works as well here as it does.
But I know there's a team of robot pilots.
Yes.
That are clearly Russian.
Yes.
That it's beyond a sketch. We see a couple shots
of them.
Well,
they're Russian.
They have heavy accents. This leads This leads very much to the Star Wars phenomenon, where there's something going on in the background, and it's distinct enough to make a toy out of, but we never really get anything. And I was really hoping for just a little bit more development. For those of you who haven't seen the movie, these giant robots require two people to operate, and they have to be linked with their brains. It's called neural drift.
The drift, yeah.
The drift.
Yeah. Neural handshake.
So they're linked in their brains, and the two people have to be compatible. And so one of the teams is a father and son, and this Russian team is the Australians.
No, I know. Is that revealed right up front?
I think so, but I actually applauded the fact that they didn't lay that on thick.
Okay. I just want to make sure that wasn't a spoiler.
Because at the end, yeah. Again, maybe this is the father-son theme, I thought that was moving.
Okay.
Where the father has all these things he has to say,
right.
But because they've been linked with a neural handshake, the son already knows them.
Right.
The thing I wish they had spent 5 more minutes on is, when we go to the compound for the first time,
yes.
There are 3 Asian boys
yes.
playing basketball.
Yes.
And the assumption is they're triplets.
Right.
And the 3 of them pilot the robot
yes.
as they're linked. And the minute you see them, you say, I said, cannon fodder. They're going down. And on the drive home, Jan even mentioned they're even wearing red shirts.
Well, their robot is red. Let's get into, I guess, spoilers now,
yes.
because we kind of already are.
On the subject of the Asian girl, who I like so much, because movies have a tendency of casting much older men with much younger women,
yes.
they parcel out her backstory so slowly that for about 10 or 15 minutes, I thought she had been romantically linked with the Idris Elba character. The Idris Elba character does not want to go her to go out on a mission. He's very protective of her. And the first thing I thought was they had had a thing together.
Right.
And I don't think I'm dumb. I think the film wants us to think that for at least a while.
I didn't get that, but maybe I just missed it.
But as the film goes on, we discover that he, in essence, has raised her, that he was a soldier and found her in the rubble and raised her as his own. And I thought that was done really well to the extent, and again, maybe this is fathers and sons. At the end, he says to her, I'm proud of you. And I really thought it carried weight, and I thought it was very moving.
Yeah.
But I wanted to get to her backstory because it was one of the most amazing things about the film. And I have a feeling now I'm getting into personal territory where no one else listening to this has ever experienced this. We see that her family was wiped out in one of the original kaiju attacks. Kaiju are these monsters that rise from the sea. They're like Godzilla. And we see, courtesy of the neural drift, her backstory, and she's left alone in the rubble screaming for her parents, and she's lost one of her shoes. She's carrying the shoe. For some reason, carrying a shoe becomes a thing in this film. And in the distance, the monster's coming. And at that point, I almost gasped. Because when I was a child, I used to watch a lot of Godzilla movies. And it led to me having a lot of really vivid dreams. I never remember my dreams. And on the occasions that I do, I'm glad I don't remember my dreams. But when I was a child, one of my most vivid dreams is, I'm home, and over there on the horizon, Godzilla's coming. And you can kind of make it out,
mm-hmm.
and it's terrifying. And that backstory, it was like
yeah.
recreating this dream that Godzilla caused. And I think in its roughest outline, a nightmare that a lot of children have, you're small, there's incredible forces, there's
right.
nothing you can do.
Right.
But I thought those flashbacks were very effective.
I found myself just being grateful that we didn't have to. Another movie would have shown the attack and shown her parents killed.
Yeah.
And for a movie that does have a lot of destruction in it, I don't feel like it sort of wallows in the destruction. A lot of the fights take place out in the ocean away from the cities. And at one point, a city is under attack, but they make a point of saying that the people have been relocated to these underground bunkers. And so you don't get the sense that millions are dying the way you have in every other movie this summer.
As we watched Pacific Rim, I kept comparing the city being destroyed sequences with Man of Steel and thinking that Pacific Rim comes out on the side of humanity.
It does. The movie really does, and that's part of why I think it's old-fashioned as well, that it really is about this idea of we're under attack, let's group together and fight and win.
And that's part of the old-fashioned nature, maybe not the generic storyline or the characters, but that's part of the old-fashioned part I really liked. And at that point, I'm watching the film, and I'm comparing it to The Lone Ranger. And I don't want to shit on The Lone Ranger, because a lot of people like it, especially the first 20 minutes and the last 20 minutes, which are rousing. But in terms of the intentional or unintentional messages that the film gives to young people, and for little kids to see Pacific Rim, there's some wonderful lessons that you have to work together.
Right.
We have to band together, and together we can do this, that other people are important, which I liked a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I'm giving the impression that I like the movie more than I did, and I don't want to just turn into, here's what's wrong with it. But I'm pointing out all these things that I liked, but I also still feel like, on the whole, the movie has a lot of problems and never quite comes together. Because honestly, it wasn't, while I like the ideas of giant robots fighting giant monsters, and I gotta say, I give credit to Guillermo del Toro for not just resting on that idea that... I've talked about this before, you know, the summer that Transformers came out and I didn't like it. All these assholes are saying it's giant robots fighting. What more do you want? Well, tell me a story, make a movie.
And as I watched Pacific Rim, and again, I missed the first two Transformers movies purposefully. And then Doug dragged me to part three. And I've told that story before, that it seems as if Del Toro noticed one of the narrative deficiencies of Transformers. And his fix is, these robots have human beings inside of them,
right.
Human beings that you might have a stake in.
Right.
And I thought that was smart.
He doesn't just rest on this idea of, my movie has giant robots and giant monsters, my work is done. He tries to make a movie.
I'm going to put people in the robots, piloting the robots, that I'm going to try and
right.
make you care about.
Right.
Now, whether he accomplishes
right.
that final task is... under question. What did you think of Idris Elba in this?
I mean, he's good because he's always good, you know? He's just a charismatic guy. I thought his character was going towards an interesting place, and then like every other character in the movie, it kind of stops short. He is emotionally closed off. He's very professional. He cares about Rinko Kikuchi, and he has a nosebleed. Done. Then we find out, you know, why he has the nosebleed, and it's so he can make the sacrifice that he also makes in Prometheus, and that's fine. It's all fine,
oh.
But again, it's sort of very broadly sketched, and in certain scenes, I thought it was great, and then the rest of the time, I thought it was just kind of generic.
I like when he's allowed to use his real voice,
yeah,
because he's done so many things
right.
where he hasn't. I would argue that he has one of the only memorable lines of dialogue in the film.
Is it the canceling the apocalypse?
No.
Okay, because that's in all the trailers.
And I must say, this is when we get into summer blockbuster territory, because Pacific Rim is one of 100 examples of popular entertainment that rip off the St. Crispin's Day speech from Henry V. Mystery Men did it. Independence Day did it. In Pacific Rim, he's only given like 4 sentences.
Right.
And he manages to convey, oh yeah, we're
right.
ripping off Shakespeare, but it's very short. It might give you some idea of how banal and stereotyped and sort of dull the dialogue is, but I thought one of his lines was memorable. May I spoil it?
Yeah.
Well, or else we should...
We're in spoilers. We're
seeing the film.
Yeah, we're in spoilers.
The main character, whose name I've already forgotten because of his graceless performance, tries to hit him or something. He's
yeah.
so insubordinate.
This
he tries
was my
to
other
hit him.
Guess.
And Idris Elba says, first of all, never touch me again. And second of all, never touch me again.
Yeah, I think that has more to do with the way he sells it. Honestly, so aside from the sort of excitement that, oh, this movie has... sort of dispatched all of the setup, and like you said, is starting in the second act. That made me excited. It honestly wasn't until, I guess it would be the second big kaiju attack that I really even started liking the movie. Because there's a long stretch. It opens with a kaiju attack where Charlie Hunnam's brother is killed. Then there's a long stretch where there's nothing. And then there's another one kind of in the middle, and that's where the other two kaiju are taken out, the three Asian brothers. And that pissed me off because they introduce a kaiju with three arms that looks like it's going to be super cool and then do nothing with
right.
it.
Yeah.
And listen, I give the movie credit for all of the sort of world building it does, and it doesn't dwell on a lot of stuff. It throws out a lot of these ideas that there's these black market kaiju dealers and everything is neon and it's Blade Runner.
Their ground up bones is supposedly some sort of aphrodisiac.
And they're making cities out of the skeletons, which I thought was just thoughtful because one of the first things we may ask ourselves is, well, what the hell are they doing with these bodies?
Because no film ever answers that.
Right.
I thought that was clever. Another thing that I liked a lot is that while clearly this is a film for 10-year-olds to love, the film is not shy about bringing up other matters and then not hitting you over the head with it.
Mm-hmm.
Once our main character stops being a robot pilot, he goes to work building a wall that some governments decide that the best way, get ready for it, folks, the best way to keep aliens out is to build a big wall. And one of my favorite parts in the film is one of the kaiju, one of the monsters, breaks through the wall like it's newspaper.
Right.
And one of the workers building it says, well, that didn't stop them at all. And I thought, you know, what's that old thing? If you want to send a message, use Western Union. But I thought it was subtle.
Yeah.
It's there if you wanted it. You could ignore it if you don't. But I really like that sort of political comment. What did you think of Charlie Day?
Again, sort of an interesting character, and I'm not, I like Charlie Day enough in the right role. I was not crazy about his performance in this movie, nor was I crazy about the performance of his buttoned-down British scientist counterpart.
When we're introduced
to him, one believes in math, one believes in theory, whatever.
When we're first introduced to the British guy, he's wearing a hat or a helmet or something, and when he took it off, I thought it was Crispin Glover. And I spent the rest of the movie being disappointed that it wasn't Crispin Glover. But it might speak to the fact that the minute it's CGI characters fighting each other, I kind of check out, which is why I appreciated the fact that Del Toro put human beings inside the robots, that the subplot with Ron Perlman as this illegal kaiju part dealer and Charlie Day, I thought was very entertaining. Maybe because of, you know, that it wasn't two CGI robots fighting. But I really liked that part, and I also think Del Toro kept that in proportion to what it should be.
Yeah. I just feel like the movie was so full of sort of these half measures where it would start down a path and then kind of bail, like with the Charlie Day character where he does the handshake or whatever with one of the kaiju.
He connects with the brain of a kaiju, and we discover that he didn't just get information.
Exactly.
They got information.
That's interesting.
And nothing's done with
exactly.
it. In fact, at one point, one of the kaijus rampaging through the city, apparently looking for Charlie Day.
And it goes nowhere.
Finds him, digs a hole so that he can get to him, and then, in this part I didn't understand at all, my wife is explaining it to me on the ride home, he's distracted by something.
Doesn't the other Jaeger show up?
Right. But the way it was portrayed, he's looking for Charlie Day, he digs a hole in the shelter to find him. When the kaiju, the monster, whirls around, I thought he was going to take a dump down the hole
as a
sight gag. Well, it's also the Lone Ranger, and I don't mean to get into the Lone Ranger rant.
About horse poo.
But the thing, do we really need to see the horse's tail rise, the poo actually come out of his ass and
it's
hit the ground?
Because an animal did a thing that all animals do, see? But then we drag his head through it, so it's hilarious.
But this is where I didn't think I was losing my mind, because it turns out my wife, too, thought that's what was going to happen and felt it was set up because Perlman explains their excrement is worth...
Right.
Because it's like the best fertilizer on the planet.
So even though they could have gone for a poo joke that they had set up, they didn't. But yeah, the movie kind of bails on that idea. And I'm also pretty tired of the trope of we know the aliens' plans because we've linked with them telepathically, right. And we see what they see, and now we know what they're doing.
And that leads to what I feel is the film's biggest failing.
Okay.
That as much as I can channel my 10-year-old, as Steven Spielberg instructs all of us to do, and imagine watching this at 10 and loving it, and maybe even buying the toys and hitting them together, the more you examine it, this film owes so much to Independence Day. It's crazy.
Which isn't such a bad thing. I wish more blockbusters would take a page from Independence Day than whatever they are.
Charlie Day is Brent Spiner, and all Del Toro has done is sort of split the Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum characters, turning Will Smith, who's a pilot, into this actor whose name I can't remember, who's a pilot, and he's made the Jeff Goldblum the comic relief. Although, in a weird way, Jeff Goldblum is some of the comic relief in Independence Day.
Yeah.
Kind of, although a lot of that is handed to his dad.
Okay.
And, oddly enough, to Brent Spiner. That there's this threat, there's this alien threat, we have to break through their defenses and deliver the bomb or whatever it is. I mean, it's really close.
Sure.
It's like someone watched Independence Day and said, you know what's wrong with that movie? We don't fight with them enough. It's like they were so carried away by Will Smith punching, "Welcome to Earth!" They said, what if you had a half an hour of Will Smith punching the alien?
But listen, I feel like I'm complimenting Pacific Rim more than I maybe liked it, but it's certainly in the spirit of Independence Day, and that is refreshing to see a summer movie that's very much in the spirit
of
Independence
Day.
Okay,
of another film that we love.
Sort of, it's positive, and it means well, and yay, we win. You know, the way that things are solved, we have to drop this bomb down the hole that the kaiju come out of, all of that I felt was really, again, sort of half-assed, that we discover that in order to get down there, we have to bring a kaiju with us.
Yes.
Otherwise, it'll know that it's whatever. But it's very, okay, we got the kaiju corpse, let's go. Okay, it's done. A better movie
would have made it really
hard for him to get the kaiju corpse. They kill it, and then he goes to get it, and something takes it away. You know what I mean? Like, you have to keep building
or that it's been dead for so long and the sensor won't read.
You have to make it harder than just, I killed it, let's go.
The fact that they established that Charlie Day has linked to one of the brains of the kaiju and that he got information from them, but they got information from him, I feel was the gun left in the drawer.
Right.
That the climax should have had something more intimately to do with the fact that Charlie Day has this unique connection to them.
Yes.
But all it turns out to be is information,
right,
which leads to this very generic, we found a way to deliver the bomb.
And it's not that much different than what they were already planning to do. What they were already planning to do was drop a bomb down the hole. And all the only new information they found out is, you got to bring one of them with you.
Right.
Okay.
So in essence,
so let's do that.
We're visiting friends. No, you have to bring a dessert.
This is purely subjective. But one of my issues with the movie is just, I didn't particularly like the aesthetic. I thought it was kind of ugly looking.
Yeah.
And other people will not have that issue, so I recognize that that's only a fault in myself. Part of the problem is that, you know, the special effects are great, but the digital revolution in terms of special effects has made things, it's too easy to make things overly busy. And I miss sort of the cleanliness of, say, the first Star Wars. Here's this big frame. There's one or two things that you look at and you say, holy shit. Because this movie is jam-packed with information.
Of course, when Lucas does the special editions, he's going to fill those spaces with tomfoolery. Most of it takes place at night. Most of it takes place in the water.
Yeah.
Most of the time it's raining. It is raining a lot. And I wondered if Del Toro was sort of channeling Akira Kurosawa. Because if you've ever seen The Seven Samurai, the main battle sequence takes place in the rain. Which I know the first time I saw the film, I thought, that's a really bold decision. Because this isn't CGI, obviously. It's actors on an outdoor set. And deciding to make it rain is giving yourself 10 headaches that you wouldn't have had. So I wondered if that was part of it. But also, because I think this film is for 10-year-olds, I thought, wouldn't it at least be a change of pace to have one of the fights happen in daylight?
Yes.
Just for variety.
Yes. I think the rain thing, I have always read it as just a way of masking the special effects. I felt like the kaiju weren't that interesting to look at. They all suffer from that sort of Super 8 phenomenon where they just are sort of this nondescript three rat, bat, spider, whatever you call it. A little better than that, but they all look... I felt like they all should have been really different looking from one another, and they're not.
The only one who's really different is, and I think they've already exploited this toy-wise, is Knifehead.
Right.
Who's the first one.
Right.
In that first fight. But speaking of the monsters, and I think this is germane. This is not a tangent.
Okay.
Yesterday, Mr. Adam Risky and I attended G-Fest. And I thought it was appropriate because, A, I had attended Wonderfest when the guy behind G-Fest won Monster Kid of the Year because he's been putting out a magazine called G-Fan for 20 years, and this is their 20th convention.
Explain what G-Fest is.
It's a horror film convention, but it's completely devoted to kaiju, which Guillermo del Toro lovely chose that word for the monsters, but kaiju is this generic term for movies where a big guy in a rubber suit attacks Japan. And the magazine is devoted to a love of these films, and he started to have a convention, and I had never been to the convention before, even though it's in our own backyard. So after seeing him at Wonderfest accept this award, I thought to myself, I'm going to try G-Fest, and Risky came with me. And this is a group that loves these things. And I thought, first of all, they did something right. First of all, if you get a chance, you should go to G-Fest because the convention is really run right. When I went to Wonderfest, attendance was down, and I wondered if that was because Wonderfest was the same weekend as Star Trek Into Darkness, and it's the same fan base, and people wanted to see the movie instead. The Friday, 2 days ago, the first day of G-Fest hosted a screening of Pacific Rim at the Pickwick Theater, and then later in the day on Friday had an open discussion section, what did you think? And they repeated it yesterday, but I didn't stay that long because I was dying to hear what those people thought of Pacific Rim, but I thought it was very smart that they decided to make it part of it. This is not a tangent.
Okay.
One of the highlights of G-Fest was Adam and I attended the screening of a new documentary called Men in Suits about the guys inside the suits. And one of the people who are interviewed in this documentary is Guillermo del Toro, because Brian Steele and Doug Jones play a lot of the crazy characters in Hellboy and Pan's Labyrinth. And del Toro goes on at some length about the guys in the suits. And so it struck me, I'm guessing it was economics or the studio, why aren't the monsters in this film played by guys in suits?
Yeah.
This is a 90-minute documentary, which I really recommend to everyone. You can buy it online. It is terrific. It is so good. That this 90-minute film establishes that there's something you get with a guy in a suit that you don't get from CGI. And then when CGI began, Doug Jones said, all of us thought we're out of a job.
Mm-hmm.
But as it turns out, the answer might be guys in suits, and then the suit is augmented with CGI, and there's examples of that and things. That maybe it would have been ironic and quaint and kind of funny, but I would have enjoyed Pacific Rim more if the kaiju were played by guys in suits.
Maybe.
Think about that.
Sure. No, I would have too, but you're cutting out most of your audience. I think.
So you literally think that if it was CGI robots fighting guys in suits,
yeah,
people would say, oh, I'm not going to go see that shit.
Or they would see it and laugh it off. I think the majority of the people, you know, this movie's having a hard enough time sort of finding an audience as it is. And I think the people who aren't passionate about some of these things, I think would have a big problem with it.
Given how oddly in Pacific Rim that the kaiju actually move,
yeah,
they're certainly not graceful.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if it would have been that much different.
I don't know.
except for their size and the sometimes elaborate things that their faces do.
Right.
I don't see much of a difference, although Del Toro does have an out. He's quoted in the film as saying, "The only time I would use CGI is when the character is too small or too big for a suit actor to play it."
Well, there you go.
But I think back to Pan's Labyrinth, which had some wonderful suited characters.
Yeah.
And I love that film so much.
Yeah.
And it's one of the main reasons I went to Pacific Rim.
Sure.
I want to see Transformers done by the guy who did Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, he's, you know, I like Del Toro a lot. I've always found him to be better with imagination than with story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some truth to that with Pacific Rim. There are moments throughout that you sort of laugh out loud because you're excited at how cool the thing is. And one of them has been spoiled a lot in all the trailers, where he picks up the boat and he's dragging it through the city. And he's, I mean, it's a great moment, but it's been spoiled. The only other one I can think of is when it's in, again, that middle fight scene, which to me is the best thing in the movie, where the Jaeger is fighting the kaiju and we think it's going to win. And then
Jaeger is a fighting robot. Yes. I don't think we've established
that. And then all of a sudden, the kaiju reveals that it has wings and it takes off. And it's this great thing. And I wish that the movie had more of those kinds of surprises in store.
If you become really, really good at piloting a Jaeger, you become a Jaegermeister. Okay, just wanted to get that out. There was also a moment that I liked, because it really harkens back to the Godzilla movies of my youth that I loved. Along the line of the boat, there's a scene where the robot uses train cars.
Yeah.
As a weapon,
yeah.
One train car in either hand,
yeah.
And almost Three Stooges, what would you call it?
He
knocks them together with a kaiju head in between.
Right. There's a few, when they establish he's out of weapons, nope, we have one more, sword. And this sword comes out and you're like, oh, this is going to be so cool. And he sort of stabs something and then the sword breaks. And it's all these
half measures. And that's the sword in the drawer. Here's another half measure. In one of the fights, it's established that one of the kaiju has acid spit.
Yes.
And it's devastating.
Right.
And we never see it again.
Nope.
I guess there's a limited amount of acid spit, and once you're done, you've shot your load.
Again, lots of imagination, but does it necessarily go anywhere? And here's one of the things. Am I being too hard on the movie? Because, as you have said more than once, it's made for 10-year-olds. And 10-year-olds don't care as much about developing characterization. And 10-year-olds maybe, I don't think, care that much about, well, they don't do much with the sword, even though I think instinctively they might know it. They don't really care. But the problem is that now all Hollywood blockbusters are made sort of with a 10-year-old sensibility, but they're all geared towards adults. So this movie isn't, it may be made for 10-year-olds, but it's all of us who are going to see it.
Risky and I were talking about this yesterday, and I'm sorry that I keep channeling Adam, but it's out of respect, that we have the Pixar and their imitators animated films, which are for small children, and then we have everything else. And it seems to me that when I was growing up, there was a class of films that were young adult films, mm-hmm. that were YA films that were meant for preteens, and those films don't exist anymore. Because I would suggest, and maybe it's a marketing strategy, that Hollywood is saying, you're either still in Pixar country or you're ready for the big leagues. And one of the things I liked about Pacific Rim is that it's the type of movie that I want 10-year-olds to see.
Right.
That it's the film equivalent of young adult literature. And what disappointed me about The Lone Ranger is that The Lone Ranger easily could have been a film for 10-year-olds, but they decided to be mocking and postmodern and ironic, and as you said, the greatest thing I've heard about The Lone Ranger. If you see The Lone Ranger because you love The Lone Ranger, this film tells you you're a fool.
Right.
You're a fool to like that. Well, no, I thought believing in these values. Oh, no. Tonto will set you straight. And also a naked land grab by Depp to make Tonto the main character. Let's not talk about The Lone Ranger. Given how disappointing a lot of things this summer
yes.
have been,
yes.
I recommend Pacific Rim.
I would too. I don't think it's a perfect movie, like you said when we started. And it's clear, unlike The Lone Ranger, not to go back to that, where they're sort of mocking this thing, Del Toro loves the giant monsters. He loves the giant robots. He loves the world that he's created. And I really liked at the end, the very last credit in the movie is the dedication to
Ray Harryhausen and Inoshiro Honda.
Yes, the director of the original Godzilla. And that tells you everything, that this is a movie made very much with love and respect for the things that it's paying tribute to.
And please note, I think I speak for both of us, we have no problem with irony.
Sure.
But it's so pervasive
yeah.
that it's become a breath of fresh air when any movie plays it straight.
Right.
Tell the story. Believe in the dramatic narrative you're foisting on us.
Right.
Wouldn't that be a thing?
And this is almost a, sort of a side conversation, but we talk a lot, especially on these summer movie shows, about the polarization of audience response, that everything's either the best or the worst, and it's already happening with Pacific Rim. I, according to the online community, I don't love it enough, and then there's a lot of people who already are saying, you know, it's not that great. I feel like there are certain critics, and some who I really like, who a year or two ago had decided that this was going to be the movie to end all movies, and have sort of stuck to that narrative. I've heard comparisons that say, it's going to be Star Wars for the generation of 10-year-olds right now, and I just can't get on board with that. And I'm as excited as anybody by the fact that somebody handed Guillermo del Toro $150 million to make a movie about giant robots and giant monsters fighting. That's terrific. But that doesn't mean that I automatically have to think the movie is a rousing success.
Right, and that's why I think it's so interesting and why I'm glad we're doing a podcast on it. This film is firmly in the middle.
Yeah.
It is fine. It is not a masterpiece. It is not a disaster.
Right.
It's a popcorn movie.
And it does some things right, and of course, we tend to respond to it more because it's pushing certain buttons in us.
Yes.
But I feel like, unfortunately, a lot of modern film criticism, and I'm not talking about Rex Reed, and I'm not talking about Armand White, who gave Grown Ups 2 a good review. I'm talking about, you know, sort of the shift towards online film criticism. I'm not even talking about, you know, message boards and stuff, because I stay out of that. I fear that a lot of modern, especially online film criticism, has become nothing but buttons. That I have these buttons, and as long as they're pushed, as long as you show me Superman punching shit, I will love this movie because finally Superman punches shit.
And I would even take it one step further to say if it, during the years of Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, we sort of bemoan the fact that people would look at the stars and not read the review. Well, we've gone even farther, and now film criticism is binary.
Right.
It's a yes or a no.
Yeah.
And the yes is crazy outsized, like you said. It's the new Star Wars or it's nothing. And the no is shit, shit, shitty
shit. And perhaps one is in response to the other, that
there's
it's
no
this
middle
shouting
ground.
Match.
Right. There's no middle ground. Pacific Rim proudly occupies the middle ground.
Yeah.
But it's worth seeing.
I think people are upset. I don't think people want it to occupy the middle ground. Because the summer has been bad so far. Maybe because this is the kind of movie that we should be supporting more. That we want to love it so badly that we're maybe disappointed that it doesn't all work. And it doesn't all work.
I'm not claiming that.
Yeah. But it is certainly old-fashioned in a good way and has lots of imagination. And sometimes that's enough.
And a cool fight.
And a cool fight.
And I might just buy one of the toys.
I'm guessing you will. I'm guessing you will. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Stick around. Next week, we'll be talking about Grown Ups 2 again. Go see it.